Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
I think government health experts during this pandemic need to show caution in their prognostications.
Why are so many people dunking on science these days?
Virtually every day we seem to hear from you things we can't do. But when you're asked, can we go back to school? I don't hear much certitude at all. I hear, well, maybe it depends.
When the truths of science are always shifting, should we still trust it?
Sometimes you have to make extrapolations because you need to at least give some sort of recommendation.
You can sort of see why if people have this idea that science is about truth, they're going to be taken aback when it turns out science is telling them a bunch of wrong stuff.
Our guest is Anne Thresher, co-author of The Tangle of Science.
Science isn't about truth, it's about reliability. And the reason science is reliable is partially because it's full of false theories.
Why trust science?
I am a scientist, not a philosopher!
Coming up on Philosophy Talk.
Is science just one error after another?
Or is it the only way to arrive at the truth?
If it isn't true, why does it work so well?
Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. We're coming to you from the studios of KALW San Francisco Bay Area.
Continuing conversations that begin at Philosopher's Corner on the Stanford campus, where Ray teaches philosophy and I direct the Philosophy and Literature Initiative.
Today we're asking, why trust science?
Well, you know, that's a great question, Ray. I'm not sure we should.
Really? How can you doubt the method that helps us build bridges and skyscrapers and formulate life-saving medicines and understand the cosmos?
Do we understand the cosmos? Scientists have had a lot of theories. Most of them are wrong. I mean, astronomers used to think the sun revolved around the Earth. Doctors used to think leeches could cure disease.
Well, yeah, Josh, but they don't think those things anymore. We proved them wrong with the scientific method.
Sure, and look what scientists believe now. Don't you think we might prove those things wrong, too, someday in the future?
Yeah, fine, but we're guaranteed to reach the truth eventually. We just have to keep gathering evidence until we know which theory is right.
I don't know. Gathering evidence isn't going to be enough. You also have to convince people, and that isn't always easy. Take Ignaz Semmelweis. He was a doctor in 19th century Vienna, and everyone around him thought that patients were dying because they had, like, an imbalance of humors.
Wait, imbalance of what?
Exactly. And Semmelweis showed that washing your hands between patients was, guess what, a good way to keep them alive.
Well, I guess that disproves the imbalance of humors theory.
Well, you might think so, but his colleagues were not convinced. He just couldn't persuade them that disease is caused by these, you know, tiny blobs you can't see. And that's why science doesn't always make progress, right? You're always going to have one or two people who get it, and a whole bunch of people who refuse to face the facts.
Well, of course, science isn't going to guarantee that everyone will believe the truth. It just guarantees that if people follow its methods, then they'll arrive at the truth. But that's already pretty cool, you know? It means that all we have to do is set aside our biases and be objective and use the scientific method.
But Galileo used the scientific method, and, you know, he was wrong about all kinds of things. He thought the tides were caused by the Earth's rotation. You know, now we know they're caused by the moon.
Of course he was wrong about some things, but being wrong is a step on the way to being right. Scientists adopt theories and then subject them to rigorous tests. So if your theory fails the test, you stop believing it, and eventually the only theories left standing are going to be the true ones.
What does it mean, though, to fail a test? I mean, if your data don't match your theory, that could just mean your telescope's broken or there's dust on the lens.
Okay, I get that you have intellectual doubts, but when push comes to shove, you trust science just as much as I do. Look at you, talking away into that fancy radio microphone, confident that the radio waves are going to reach thousands of people. What kind of hypocrite are you anyway?
The kind with a fancy microphone?
Okay, but seriously, you have to admit, you rely on science all the time.
All right, yeah, fair enough. I do depend on science a lot in my everyday life. Science works, I'll give you that. It just doesn't mean that it's true.
Ah, I think you do trust science after all.
Maybe, but I'm not sure I have good reason to.
I give up. I hope our guest can convince you. It's Anne Thresher from Stanford, co-author of the new book, The Tangle of Science.
Thinking of trying to convince people about science, when it comes to topics like drug use, people don't always trust the research. They often let their politics get in the way.
So we sent our roving philosophical reporter, Holly J. McDeed, to investigate how emotions can trump science when it comes to stopping drug users from overdosing. She files this report.
Dr. Phil isn't a licensed doctor, but it's no surprise he has a lot of opinions on how the country should address addiction. He's not a fan of safe consumption sites where people can use drugs under medical supervision.
Talking about, you know, safe places, safe havens, clean needles, it can be taken as an implicit endorsement that this is now safer, that it's okay.
In this episode, he talked to Maya Solovitz, the author of Undoing Drugs. She says the data shows that syringe exchange programs are effective.
People who participate in syringe exchange programs, in prescription heroin programs in Europe, are more likely to get into abstinence or other forms of recovery.
But that argument does not persuade Dr. Phil.
What is the exit strategy? And the answer is there isn't one.
No, that's not true.
It is true. There is not an exit strategy.
Yes, there is.
And of course, Dr. Phil is Dr. Phil. But he's not the only person who feels that way. Instead of punishing people who use drugs or forcing them to quit, harm reduction focuses on reducing the risks of drug use. Solovitz says that philosophy saved her life. During the AIDS crisis in the 1980s, while addicted to heroin and cocaine, she met someone who had some advice.
She told me, you know, I shouldn't share, but if I had to share, I should, you know, clean the works twice with bleach and then twice with water. And she probably saved my life.
In San Francisco, people stocked bleach in corner stores, bars, and taquerias. Advocates also distributed clean needles without permission from the government.
The whole history of harm reduction in the United States and really internationally is first things are done illegally and underground, and then the sky doesn't fall.
That's Rachel McLean. Back in the 1990s, she worked as an outreach worker in San Francisco when the city was seeing a wave of heroin overdoses. She was part of the push to distribute Narcan, the medication used to reverse overdoses. McLean still remembers the first time learning about a save.
We call it a save when you give somebody naloxone and then they use it to, like, reverse somebody else's overdose. I can't even describe it. It was just such an incredible feeling of being like, we're doing it. Like, this is working, you know? We are giving people who use drugs the tools to save each other's lives.
The results were promising.
We gave out, you know, thousands of doses and many lives were saved.
Joshua Bamberger, a professor of medicine at UCSF, was the only physician prescribing naloxone in San Francisco for many years. And the death toll from heroin overdoses plummeted from a peak of 155 in the mid-90s to 10 in 2010. Flash forward to today, fentanyl is killing people in record numbers.
Just when the drug dealers come up with a new drug, we need to come up with a new response. I think it's our job as physicians to give people the tools so they don't come to greater harm from their addiction or their illness. First, do no harm, primum non necessary.
Still, despite the overwhelming evidence that safe consumption saves lives, many political leaders are not persuaded. In 2022, California Governor Gavin Newsom vetoed a measure to create a pilot program for safe consumption sites, saying they could have unintended consequences.
The law and order stance that many politicians have learned is a successful position to be in to get elected is not the stance that science supports.
Bamberger says harm reduction is only controversial when it comes to substance use, perhaps because of our own fear of losing control. So some people might think, well, what's going to get me to do something? And the answer might be consequences. But those threats don't work for people living with addiction.
I think that there's a lot of cultural misappropriation by taking more middle-class values and projecting it onto drug users and assuming that that's going to fit.
And instead of TV pseudo-doctors, we could look to real doctors who study addiction and their results. Since opening safe consumption sites in New York, hundreds of overdoses have been reversed. For Philosophy Talk, I'm Holly Timmickdean.
Thanks for that great report, Holly. I'm Josh Landy. With me is my Stanford colleague, Ray Briggs. And today we're asking, why trust science?
We're joined now by Anne Thresher. She's a science ethicist at the New Door School for Sustainability at Stanford University and co-author of The Tangle of Science, Reliability Beyond Method, Rigor, and Objectivity. Anne, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Thanks for having me.
So Anne, you've written books and articles on the philosophy of science, but what first got you interested in all that?
So I've always been interested in science ever since I was a little kid. My parents are both scientists, and I have these vivid memories of being a kid and doing experiments at home with my parents. And then I remember my dad, who was a genetic biologist, he ended up stealing some of my pet fish when I was a kid. I used to breed guppies. And I remember being really upset when I was about 8 years old because he... not because he took my fish away, but because he wouldn't give them back after they were glowing in the dark. Something about government regulations and labs. So I've always been interested in these topics and why science can help us figure out how the world works.
That's so cool. I remember getting these science by mail kits as a kid, where you got like a little experiment that you could do, building a circuit or something. You had a scientist to correspond with about your experiment, and my scientist, like me, had really bad vision, so I felt an immediate intellectual connection. We were both the same. But earlier, I was trying to persuade Josh that you can trust science, but he wouldn't listen to me. So can you convince him? Why should we trust science?
Yeah, so I think you mentioned something that I think is really important here. So the conversation was really based around truth, that science is true. But you mentioned the word reliability, that we can rely on science. And I think that's really the key to understanding why we should trust science. It's not because it's true. As Josh pointed out, it's often wrong about lots of things. But what it does do is get us at reliable results. We can trust it to do the things we ask it to do.
So what does reliability come to? Does that mean basically if I just know if I do the same thing, I'll get the same result? So if, you know, around the country right now, probably 10,000 kids are making a volcano out of baking powder and vinegar. And we know you combine those two things, you get a chemical reaction. Is that what we mean by reliability?
Yeah, it really is sort of reliability in the everyday sense, right? You can rely on your car to get you to work in the morning, but you can't rely on it to make you scramble eggs, right? Like, reliability is particularly interesting because it gets at these questions of, like, reliable for what, in what context? And so when kids are making these volcanoes, they're relying on, you know, if I mix these two compounds together and put it in this particular container, I get these results. And it's not guaranteed that every time. There's all sorts of confounding factors that can come in. But, you know, if you do the same thing over and over again, science tells you that you'll get the same sorts of results out. And that's really why it works.
So that's kind of an interesting answer, because like a baking soda volcano is not even the kind of thing that can be true or false. And usually I think about like trusting scientific theories or trusting scientific predictions. Should I be shifting my focus to other stuff besides items that can be true or false?
Yeah, I think that's exactly the way we should be thinking about science. So when we put the emphasis on science being a true thing, not only do we run into the problems of like, well, it's not always true, but science is composed of a lot more things than just theories and measures and hypotheses that can be true or false. It's also experiments and data and methodologies and models, all these things that don't necessarily take truth values, but are just as important to the way science works. And we need them to be working and doing the things we expect if we want science to do the things we want it to do.
But what if they aren't? So, I mean, obviously there's a replication crisis right now in the field of psychology, for example. So, well, there are experiments there, but somehow not all of them panned out. So can I just say, well, there's experiments and there's data sets and there's models and they're reliable, and so we can rely on science?
Well, things can be more or less reliable, right? So plenty of things that we thought were reliable end up being not all that good in the long term. But there was a reason we thought they were reliable in the first place, right? These data sets, these experiments, they looked good at the time. But part of what science is going through and double checking the reliability of things and making them more reliable, or realizing actually they didn't do what we thought we did in the first place.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about trust in science with Anne Thresher from Stanford University.
How do you rely on science in your everyday life? Has science ever failed you? How do you decide which experts to trust?
Trusting and verifying, along with your comments and questions, when Philosophy Talk continues. Do you trust science enough to let a human clone play in your band? I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs, and we're asking, why trust science? With Anne Thresher from Stanford University.
co-author of The Tangle of Science.
Got questions about today's topic? Email us at comments@philosophytalk.org or comment on our website. And while you're there, you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
So, Anne, you've told us that we should trust science because it's reliable. But you don't seem to think that science delivers up a lot of true theories, or more true theories than false ones. So why should I rely on something that has a bunch of false theories at its foundation?
Yes, this is a really good question. And in fact, I think the answer is quite counterintuitive, in that the reason science is reliable is partially because it's full of false theories.
That is counterintuitive.
It is, right? But like, when you think about the way science actually works in the real world, so I have a physics background, I use a lot of physics examples, but the one that always strikes me is Newtonian mechanics, right? That's something we're taught in high school, like everyone sort of gets some sort of grounding in Newtonian mechanics, you know, F equals MA, but that's false.
Yeah,
it's a wrong theory.
Bad flashbacks.
Yeah. Like throwing bowls in classes and measuring things, yeah.
It's obviously incomplete as a theory, right? I mean, but Einsteinian physics, right, but is it totally false?
It's false, right? So the very objects it posits, right, just turn out to not exist. It's not the kind of thing. Like what Newton was working with weren't real things in the real world. It's not that it got sort of expanded by general relativity. It got replaced by general relativity. And general relativity is probably going to be replaced in the long run, too. We know it's not compatible with quantum mechanics. But that doesn't stop us from using Newtonian mechanics to good effect.
So one thing I could think is like, okay, Newtonian mechanics, like lots of false parts, but at least what it predicts about physical objects, that part of it is true. So the part that matters is true. And then there's some other false stuff, but like we should really just pay attention to predictions and get those right.
Well, so the predictions are certainly very important, but like it doesn't change the fact that it's still telling you false things. But this is where the reliability comes in, because it is getting you something that does seem to work in the real world. And so when you look at something like building bridges, for example, right, when you ask engineers to do the science and figure out how to make bridges, you shouldn't ask them to use general relativity just because it's the truer theory, right, because it gets close to reality. You're asking them to use Newtonian mechanics because it is false, but it's useful. It's usefully false.
But this is the question I always have, you know, for folks who think that science somehow works but not by being true. Why? I mean, it seems like it's a miracle or a very weird fluke that it just so happens that the things that scientists claim about, for example, you know, mechanics and astronomy allow us to land a rocket on a comet, right? Or you know, the things we know about conduction and electricity allow us to build an iPhone. But is it just a weird coincidence? Why shouldn't I say, well, it works probably because people are getting something right?
Not at all. So I think there's two sort of ways to answer this. The first is that like reliability and truth aren't entirely separate. You hope that if you've got something that's reliable, like getting at something about the real world that's working, right? Newtonian mechanics may be false, but it's not completely off base. It's getting close to something that's actually happening in the real world. And the second thing is that science is designed to build better reliable systems. Like, I think part of the problem with focusing our conversation on truth is that we're not really modeling what science is actually doing. And what science is actually doing is trying to get at better results. And truth, sure, comes in at some point, but the entire structures of science are about making more and more reliable systems. So when scientists go into the lab and they're, you know, thinking about building bridges and stuff, right, they're wondering, well, okay, why is Newtonian mechanics good for this job? And that's a particularly important aspect of it. When you ask whether something's reliable, there's a secondary question. Reliable for what?
Yeah, I was about to ask about this. So if I have a reliable bridge, it's one that doesn't fall down. If I have a reliable procedure for synthesizing a chemical, it's one that makes the chemical every time. But like, is there something reliability that those have in common with every other reliable thing? What is the core concept here?
Yeah, so the important thing here, I think, is context. Science works in context. When theories are used by engineers or, you know, let's take bridges versus orbiting satellites, right? One group tends to use general relativity, the other one uses Newtonian mechanics. But, like, each of them is working within a particular context that tells you what theory you should be using, which one's going to be the most reliable. And so a lot of what scientists are doing when they're building theories and models and experiments and stuff is they're building an understanding of what context the stuff they're doing works in. The way I like to think about it is it's like sort of this dense network of pieces that you sort of scientists are pulling in to support particular products and results of science.
So can I have an example of like a dense network?
Yeah. So let's take space shuttles as a good example of this. So I want to build a space shuttle to get into space. And there's lots and lots of science that goes into that. Everything from meteorology to predict the weather on your launch to rocket fuel science, like figuring out chemical components and so forth. But let's look at a particular subset. Let's talk about welding. So I need to put my space shuttle together. And I'm building a space shuttle from scratch, and I know I need to weld the outside to make it, you know, able to withstand the pressures of space and the heat of launch and that sort of thing. And so now I, as a scientist, need to figure out what to do. And so you're trying to figure out what welding techniques to use. And there's so many pieces that come into that, that you sort of, you're building this tangled network of pieces that connect together. So I need to know, for example, well, here's a supporting piece. Has this type of welding been used for large scale materials before, right? Is it used in trucks, right? Have I done the right experiments to show that it can hold under the heat of launch? Do I have the right theories of my material science to show that these particular materials will weld together with these particular structures? And you know, like, you can just keep pulling in from all over science, and you're sort of building this thing with saying, can I rely on this piece of welding to get my, or to hold when I launch my shuttle? And so there's all these pieces you're frantically weaving together, and it's important that all the pieces are there.
So in order to do the welding, I have to rely on material science and physics and maybe some astronomy, so I know what the conditions are like in space, and maybe some chemistry. And the more things I'm relying on, the more reliable it is?
Yeah, sort of. So there are different ways we can sort of think about reliability when it comes to this, what I refer to as the tangle, right? So every piece has this tangle woven into it. And so I like to use the analogy of a nest. So think of the piece you're trying to support as an egg, and you're trying to weave something together that will hold up your egg and carefully support it. And so the better woven your nest is, the more assured you can be that your egg is going to be fine. So there are different ways your nest can be better or worse, right? So one way you can be sure that you're getting something reliable is if these things have been used in other places in science in similar contexts before, right? How far can you reach out to pull in these things? If the welding case, right? I'm reaching into, say, like fundamental physics and chemistry, but also, like, you know, the welding techniques of this particular welder, right? Like his background experience, all these other bits and pieces that come in. And so the further afield I'm reaching, the more of those I'm pulling in, the more likely it is what I'm doing is going to work.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about trust in science with Anne Thresher from the School of Sustainability at Stanford University. And we've got an email from Daniel, came through on our website. Daniel says, is part of the problem that natural science cannot include human life and that nature as a domain of objects of study by definition excludes anything affected by optional human design? In the spectacular progress of the rigorous sciences, are some surprised that science explains so little about human beings?
I'm not sure it doesn't explain that much about human beings. I mean, human beings are definitely very complicated. And part of the reason for that is that we're just intelligent beings with all these strange emotions and like complexities to the way that we interact with one another. But it's certainly the case that science can tell us a lot about how we work as a species and in terms of interpersonal relationships and the way we interact with nature. We're not separate from nature. We're continuous with it. We're still a part of this system.
Okay, I want to get back to what we were talking about a moment ago. We're talking about what you call the tangle of science. That's the title of your book.
Mm-hmm.
And how one of the reasons we can rely on science is because in many of these cases, many of the successful cases, where people are putting together information that they get from different areas and different practices and models and data sets and sort of methodologies.
Mm-hmm.
But I still want to kind of be the voice of truth is important, too. You said, look, well, you know, we have to do this test to see whether this kind of welding holds up under the conditions we need to hold. So if I do those tests, why shouldn't we say, I've got some knowledge now. I run the tests. I run them really well. Well, now I know whether or not this kind of weld can hold up in space. And that's how I can be so confident that it's going to work.
I don't think that's the wrong thing to think. So I totally don't want to suggest that reliability completely replaces truth. They're clearly related in some way, shape, or form, right? So I think you do know that under these particular circumstances, this kind of welding will hold up. Or maybe no is a little too strong, right? There's always confounding factors and things that can come in and sort of change the way this welding works, unforeseen first circumstances. But like, by and large, I think you can know. And that's part of the wonderful thing about reliability is you can know that you can rely on it, right? And so we can sort of circumvent truth to a certain extent when we replace with the reliability talk, but we're not getting rid of it completely. It's still a part of the way that we talk about the world and how we know things. Science still gives us knowledge, even if it's knowledge that now rests on, but it just seems to work in these contexts rather than it's an absolute truth and a fundamental fact about
the universe. Right, because even the statement, it's going to work. If I do this, this will happen. If I put baking soda and vinegar together, it's going to be a chemical reaction. Even that is a knowledge claim.
Yeah.
I can know that I can rely on that.
Yep, absolutely.
So I'm kind of like wondering about how I should think of the purpose of science. So one picture of the purpose of science, which seems at odds with what you're saying, is that science is mostly has the purpose of describing the universe. Like, I want to know what's true, and I want to go out and look at things and observe them, and then just, like, understand their natures. And another kind of really different idea is that science is really about engineering. I want to make stuff that works for my human aims. And so I kind of want those both to be true, and I'm not sure how to stick them together. And I see how your theory gets me science is great for engineering, and I don't see how it gets me science is great for looking at the universe and describing it when I don't even have anything I want to do with it. Like, I want to know where the universe came from, not so that I can build a thing, but just because I'm curious. How do I get that second thing?
Yeah, good. So I've been talking a lot about engineering here because it's like a nice practical use for science, but like, I don't want to make the claim or suggest that this stuff and the reliability claims are just for practical, pragmatic, we're going to build some stuff and invent new technologies and build radio mics that can transmit things and so forth. Reliability also includes things like, can I reliably know how old the universe is? Can I reliably know what an electron is? Can I reliably tell you how ecosystems like function and evolve and change over time? So reliability isn't just about like, what can I do pragmatically and practically? It's also about like, how reliable is my knowledge of the fundamental nature of the universe?
So it's not just that my beliefs help me builds bridges.
Yeah.
It's that my ability to build bridges helps me trust my beliefs.
Yeah, right? So, you know, we talk about figuring out fundamentally, you know, think about the James Webb telescope right now, which is telling us so much incredible stuff about, you know, early galaxies and so forth. And why can I trust my knowledge of that? Well, because of all this cool stuff to do with like how engineering works and how light works and these theories of general relativity and quantum mechanics and like all this cool stuff that is like all parts of science that reliably work together to give me cool information about the universe.
So this is amazing, but I have an annoying philosophy question now, which is, okay, so I rely on my theory of physics to trust that I can build a telescope that works. And I rely on my telescope to tell me that my theory of physics is true. Isn't this kind of circular? Like, why should I trust this whole system?
Yeah, good. Look, so to a certain extent, maybe a little bit, because like you are sort of like starting to loop inwards with some of these things. But one of the nice things about science in comparison to things like theology or folklore, right, is that theology and folklore often wrap in on themselves. They're self-justifying in ways that can feel a little frustrating if you're trying to figure out how the world's actually working. Whereas one of the nice things about science is that it really is reaching out into like empirical data about the real world, right? So why I'm using my physics to get my telescopes working, my telescopes to my physics working, but both those things are also reaching out into other data and other experiments. This is why it's important that science is this broad-ranging thing that's pulling from lots of varied and diverse and rich sets of objects to justify its results, right? You don't want science that only draws from one particular data point or that only has like one supporting factor for it, right? You want lots and lots of supporting factors, and this tangle will be very dense.
So yeah, this is also giving me some questions about the things you're contrasting with science. So there are lots of things that I don't think of as science, but that do figure in this network of understanding the world. So there was a couple of years back, this like extremely clever hairdresser who figured out how the wife of Marcus Aurelius styled her hair such that you could
get the shape that is depicted in sculptures of her. So Flavia. So she and so the hairdresser showed that if you sewed people's hairstyles together, you could get them to do this gravity-defying stuff that was not really achievable in other ways. And it seems like the hairdresser needed to draw on her practical knowledge of hairstyling, which was reliable, and maybe draws on things like physics and chemistry to know how hair dyes work and how hair shapes work. So is hairstyling science?
To a certain extent, yeah. I think it's kind of continuous with what science is doing. In many ways, this reliability conversation is, it's not just a thing that science does. It's about the way that we interact with the world and figure out new things all the time. So historians are doing these sorts of things, and hairdressers are doing these kinds of things every time we try and figure out new methodologies and new ways of looking and dealing with the world. Science is just a little bit different, and the scientific method and these kinds of things are designed to make it easier and better, and really like scientists are basically professional reliability machines, right? They've gotten really good at taking all these observations and figuring out how to make them really reliable and what it means to be reliable.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk. Today we're thinking about trust in science with Anne Thresher from Stanford University.
Is there a science denier in your life? How can you change their mind? Are there things the scientific community could do to win the public's trust?
Just say no to denial. Plus, commentary from Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher, when Philosophy Talk continues. You may not trust it, but you certainly can't deny it. Science is real. I'm Josh Landy, and this is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ray Briggs. Our guest is Anne Thresher from Stanford University, and we're asking, why trust science?
So Anne, since COVID, it seems like there are more science deniers than ever before out there. So what would you say to convince a denier to have more trust in science?
Well, I think a lot of it comes down to why science denialism sort of increased over COVID and, you know, things like climate change denial and that sort of thing. And there's obviously a very complicated set of reasons for why someone might mistrust science or try to undermine it. But one of the big things I think that happened over COVID, and we all remember this, were those early chaotic months when there was conflicting information coming out, different recommendations. You know, we were all leaving our groceries outside for 3 days. No one was touching the mail for a while. You know, only spend time outdoors, wash your hands for 20 seconds, for 30 seconds, for a minute, right? Like, we just had this overwhelming amount of recommendations coming out of science. And it turned out a lot of them weren't right. You know, we don't leave our groceries outside anymore. We think that COVID is not a surface contact disease anymore. And so you can sort of see why if people have this idea that science is about truth, science is supposed to tell you true things, they're going to be taken aback when it turns out science is telling them a bunch of wrong stuff, that it gets changed. And so out of this, I think, comes this idea that science, if this is wrong, what else is science getting wrong? Like, why should I believe anything that science tells me about vaccines or other things if they were wrong at the beginning? And so I think if we shift the idea, if we communicate more the idea that science is about reliability rather than absolute truths, it makes it a lot easier to show someone that what was happening at the beginning of the pandemic was that just science doing its normal everyday job. It was trying to figure out what the most reliable thing it could tell you was. And we didn't know much about COVID-19 at the time, but we had similar diseases. And so we were like, the most reliable thing you can do to avoid getting it is to wash your hands, to not touch your groceries, to avoid being in contact with people. And so
I think I'm still confused about the reliability versus truth dichotomy, because, you know, why couldn't I say to somebody, we're doing the best we can to figure out what's going on, right? So exactly how it's transmitted and what you can do to prevent the spread. And this is our best guess for now. But of course, you know, as we get more data in, we'll revise our hypotheses. That's the scientific way. And that seems still to be in the language of truth, or at least of, you know, best guess or something like that, best estimate based on the data we have now. Why dispense with the notion of truth? Why not just say, look, we're aiming at knowledge and we already have some knowledge, but, you know, this will evolve and we'll do the best we can in a given moment. Why do we have to get rid of that notion that scientists are actually doing their best to get knowledge?
again, I don't think that knowledge necessarily means we have to look at truth as a thing. I mean, I know people, philosophers in particular, talk about knowledge as a justified true belief and all these sort of things. Truth tends to come in very hard on the knowledge thing. But I think I can know something if it's something I can rely on. I can know that my car will get me to work in the morning.
Wait, I'm a little worried. So I would have thought that in order for me to know something, maybe it's not enough for it to be like a justified true belief, or maybe I don't need a justification, but doesn't it have to be true? If I rely on the understanding that my car will get me to work and it won't get me to work, then I made a mistake, even if I don't get harmed by the mistake. So even if I was relying on my car, but then at the last minute my friend said, "Do you want a carpool?" Like, I was wrong to rely on it, and I didn't know it because it wasn't true.
Yeah, look, I mean, this gets into really deeper conversations about reliabilism and, like, the way that we think about knowledge as it relates to truth and counterfactual worlds and all these other complicated concepts that I'm not sure helps right now when it comes to the science denialism mm-hmm. sort of question. So I think the shorthand for this is that, look, truth and reliability are certainly, as I said, not unrelated, but... the problem is that when we emphasize truth, when we say that science is trying to get at true facts about COVID-19, it was just confused at the beginning. Well, I think science deniers tend to latch onto those kinds of pieces of language, mm-hmm. right? They're talking about, it wasn't true. It isn't true. And we're still updating our knowledge about COVID-19 and recommendations and the way vaccines work and how they protect us. And so when we couch everything in the language of truth, when we try and push the narrative that science is all about doing true things, you open yourself up to those kinds of criticisms.
Yeah, that's helpful. And I kind of want to ask about a related thing, which is how people perceive science and authority. So I think of truth as kind of connected to authority in maybe ways that I'm a little bit suspicious of, like this idea that somebody is going to tell me what to do and I won't have to think about it ever again for myself. And if the person tells me one thing and then changes their mind because the evidence changed, then I stop trusting them because they didn't tell me what to do and I had to worry. Is that a factor, and how do I sort of understand and respond to that?
I do worry about the sort of the way we communicate what science is in our culture. You know, when we talk about scientists as authorities in something, people in high school, you're taught that science tells you facts about the world, that it teaches you how the world works, and that's what makes science different. To a certain extent, we're setting people up to then be really surprised when it turns out science is making a bunch of false predictions or making wrong statements. And so I think you're right, there's something there where, like, people believe in the authority of science and scientists, and then are really taken aback when it turns out this wasn't what was actually happening, that scientists make mistakes, that science is an evolving and changing procedure as we
and they disagree with each other.
They disagree with each other. And so this, I think, comes into places like climate change denial, right? Like, one of the strongest things that climate change deniers do is they point at false models. They say, look, you told us that climate change looked like this. You had these models. You told us this was true. But, like, now you've changed your mind. This is a completely different model now. And, like, that you're just lying to us now as you talk about these models. Like, why should we believe that this model is going to be true? You know, and so you end up in these things. And that looks, to people who think that science is an authority, that looks like a good argument.
I sort of wonder also if, like, reconceiving, like, ordinary people's relationship to science is a part of this. So like, I do think the hairdresser who studied Flavia's hairstyles was kind of doing science and, like, didn't have the social cachet of a person who wears a white coat, but did, like, inquiry. And everybody kind of tries to get reliable information in their everyday life. Like, what if science was not a thing that happened over there, but was happening over here?
Yeah, I really like that idea. I like the idea that, like, by shifting as well to this reliability idea, like, everyone's trying to do and figure out reliable things in their life, right? You're trying to reliably put on a radio show. You're trying to reliably know that you can pick your kids up from school at a certain time because school gets out of the stack. You know, there's all these, like, things we're doing in everyday lives, and we're taking all this information from all around us that, like, helps us figure out what's more or less reliable.
I'm worried about this. I go, because it just sounds potentially like a close cousin of the person who does their own research, quote unquote. I do my own research, and, you know, I'm not one of those fancy white coat wearing scientists, but I do my own research, and those scientists get it wrong all the time. And take some of this horse medicine. And to that, I don't know how we get out of that other than by saying, yeah, science is fallible and science evolves, but it's using the best available data and the scientific method to get the best possible guess as to what is actually going on.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly don't think that... So I certainly think that we can talk about better and worse scientific methods and methodologies and tangles and networks, right? This is part of the wonderful thing about science is it's really good at making these strong connections, these strong tangles. And so when we talk about people, like, take horse medicine for COVID and this thing, you can look at the evidence they have supporting that, and you can see that it's weak. You can see that they're, you know, drawing from the same three sources over and over again, that there's one paper that everything is hinging on, right? And good science doesn't look that way. And so we can start to distinguish, you know, horse medicine for COVID treatments from the hairdresser who figured out the hairstyles, right? She was looking at a broad range of things, pulling in all this external evidence, right? She's doing good science in ways that other people clearly are not. And so we can recognize a continuum.
This also makes me kind of like doing your own research is a really strange idea, because nobody really does all of their own research. You have to rely on other people to have done relevant research, and I think the idea of tangles is really helpful for that. I can't make the whole tangle. There's not enough energy and not enough time in my day.
Yeah, it's nice because, like, you know, when you start really thinking about the way that science supports a piece of, you know, product, you're not just doing your own work, you're relying on everyone else, and you're asking, well, why should I believe this particular product? Why should I allow this piece into my tangle? Well, now I can look at what that person's doing, what they've brought in, and, like, really, science is this increasingly dense network of pieces that stretch further and further out. Like, everything's, at some point, sort of interwoven into this in some way, shape, or form. But at some point, you also have to just be like, look, I think you've done something reliable, everyone's relying on you, it's worked for other people to rely on this piece, I can rely on it as well.
And arguably, the fact that scientists disagree, that's not a bug, that's a feature, because things get really tested.
It's good, because it means that you get stronger tangles.
So I have kind of one last question. We've been having this great discussion about, like, tangles and authority, but when I've got, like, a COVID denier relative, I'm not going to have enough time to get them to listen to a whole long argument. Is there one idea or one piece of information that you could leave your listeners with? It's a simple summation of why we should rely on science.
Yeah. I mean, I think the difficult to hear answer is there's almost nothing you can do in like 30 seconds to convince someone that they should trust science. They're really against it. But I think the general gist is, look, science just works. And you already rely on it in so many other areas of your life, right? It does seem like it's doing really good things for you. So if someone has picked one area where suddenly they're like, science just isn't reliable in this context, helping them see that, like, this is a dense network, that science isn't about truth, it's about reliability. And if you can rely on it in one place, you can look and figure out why you should rely on it in these other cases, like COVID denial or climate change denial.
That makes great sense to me. Thank you so much for joining us today, Anne.
Thank you for having me.
Our guest has been Anne Thresher, a science ethicist at the New Door School for Sustainability at Stanford University and co-author of The Tangle of Science, Reliability Beyond Method, Rigor, and Objectivity. So, Ray, what are you thinking now?
Well, our discussion has got me thinking about how much we have to trust each other in trying to figure out what is true and what will work. And scientists have to trust each other even when they disagree and have rivalries, and then the public has to figure out what to trust that scientists produce. And so I'm just really impressed with what a social endeavor science is. It's a tangle not just of hypotheses, but of human activities.
That makes sense. And, you know, even these scientists who are disagreeing about some things are agreeing about an awful lot else. Mm-hmm. We're going to put links to everything we've mentioned today on our website, philosophytalk.org. where you can also become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes.
And if you have a question that wasn't addressed in today's show, we'd love to hear from you. Send it to us at comments@philosophytalk.org, and we might feature it on the blog.
Now, a man you can always trust to talk at top speed, it's Ian Scholes, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholes, one of the cruel facts of life is that what we know keeps changing. Science, knowledge, social skills. I mean, it used to be common practice for people to open all the windows at a party and scream. I feel left out, when all I want to do is to be seen, you know? It all keeps changing. We take our Adderall and butter. It's all good. Well, no, it's not. It's changing. Everything changes all the time, over time, and knowing doesn't help. We're not entirely sure that time itself is even a thing. I think it used to be, and then Einstein broke the watch. Time, if you will, is just what's left after something happens. We know that now. Time is a way to measure events without looking at them directly, which, as Heisenberg showed us, only changes the nature of the event. And suddenly you have a dead cat in a box, as Schrodinger showed us, or a cat sitting in a cardboard box looking pleased with itself, as cat owners can attest happens at least once during the duration of any cat ownership. That's anecdotal, true, but the truth lies in your heart if you listen. That's just science. We can't pretend that science is not affected by culture. Culture determines what we want to measure, for one thing, and what kind of tools you'll need, top of the line, if you're asking the Appropriations Committee, not to mention money for laboratories, and enough helium to float a million birthday balloons into space if your measuring tool is a Hadron Collider. Ancient Greek physicists didn't worry about helium shortages. They didn't have telescopes. They had to use their own brains to figure out what this is and get it wrong. Except for monads, of course, the subatomic building blocks that lead directly to God, got that right in the 17th century. Not like today's quanta, although a consensus right now among people who consent to this sort of thing is that there might not even have been a beginning to all this. It all just is and was and ever more shall be, everything and nothing and God and even things that never happened, all at once, whatever once is. Or the Big Bang happened and is still happening, expanding until we start contracting again, leading to a shrinkage and multiverses and starting over again, this time with flying cars and rocket belts, knock on wood, and the blink of a microblink over eras and eons sometime in the future, which will be as yesterday. So even atheism may be just another way for God to make himself known. Science is supposed to keep us abreast regarding what's what, reality-wise, but it's falling down on the job, frankly. Again, I suppose it's part of the unchanging general principle that everything changes. Horse and buggies give way to internal combustion. Guns make way for lasers. Digital gives way to quantum computing. And before you know it, time machines, or its cousin, movies about time travel that we can stream for just pennies. Will we still have movies? Or will it all just be TV now? Well, yes, until they put the 3D chips in our brain. But they might just say they're going to put 3D chips in our brain, and it's just a trick to make us take another COVID booster. Don't trust doctors. Except in drug commercials, of course. Ask your doctor if Brelvic is right for you. Ask your doctor for a complete list of potentially lethal side effects for a drug you probably don't need. No, ask Twitter. And when it comes to supplements, ask the guy stocking the shelves in the nutritional aisle at Safeway. Experience, ability, fooey. Those are just more data points in the vast ever-changing field we call the vast ever-changing field. The point being, we can depend on science for advice like don't pet rattlesnakes, don't gargle with battery acid, don't drive faster than light in a Hyundai. We know these things to be, if not true, certainly words of wisdom. The kind of advice that used to show up in Reader's Digest back when we had Reader's Digest and magazines, and now just show up in social media so people can either agree enthusiastically or call you a libtard. So, thank you, science. Now bring back monads, okay? A lot more fun than quanta, especially on 21st century Earth, which seems to get flatter every day. Ask your doctor if gravity is right for you. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of KALW San Francisco Bay Area and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University, copyright 2023.
Our executive producer is Ben Trefney. The senior producer is Devin Strolovich. Laura McGuire is our director of research.
Thanks also to Jamie Lee, Elizabeth Zhu, Emily Huang, Merle Kessler, and Angela Johnston.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from various groups at Stanford University and from the partners at our online community of thinkers.
And from the members of KALW Local Public Radio San Francisco, where our program originates.
The views expressed or misexpressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our other funders.
Not even when they're true and reasonable. The conversation continues on our website, philosophytalk.org, where you can become a subscriber and gain access to our library of more than 500 episodes. I'm Josh Landy.
And I'm Ray Briggs. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.
Vaxadrin, the only weight loss pill recommended by Dr. Stephen T. Colbert, DFA. I am not a medical doctor. I have an honorary doctorate in fine arts, which is why my genius won't be recognized until long after my patients are dead.
Holding hands at midnight, 'neath the starry sky. Nice work if you can get it, and you can get it if you try.